Hello and welcome to DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, can police stations be friendly? As Charlie Beck takes the helm at the LAPD, we'll look at spiffy new precinct stations and find out how they help protect and serve LA. And can a supersized house have a low carbon footprint? Yes, says comedian Keenan Wayans, and he's not joking. We'll hear from him and his designers later in the show. But first, a supersized art and architecture story. The businessman and philanthropist Eli Brode has a 2,000-piece contemporary art collection. He has long loaned pieces to art museums. Now the 76-year-old wants to build his own museum. And he's considering locations and competing deals in Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, and maybe a third as yet unnamed city. Tonight, the Santa Monica City Council will consider their plan to entice him to build next door to the Civic Auditorium with a prominent architect attached. Kevin McKeown is a Santa Monica City Councilman and liaison to the Planning, Arts and Landmarks Commissions.
Well, it's wonderful. It fits right into something we have been talking about wanting for our Civic Center, which was a destination cultural museum. We tonight just looking at this conceptually, but you've correctly identified one of the challenges. This building is going to be next to the Welton Becket Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. It's not just the Civic Center, but the Civic Auditorium itself is a landmark and a very distinctive, iconic one. Besides that, it's across the street from the new RAND Corporation headquarters. So that's a deliberately egalitarian building, you know, and a very rounded facade there. Then you have Welton Becket, who always said he didn't have a style, but of course he did, and had done so many iconic buildings around Los Angeles. So then,
which include the Capitol Records,
Records building,
and the Cinerama Dome, and Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, yeah. And Mark Taper.
So a significant architect and a landmark building. So it's going to be a very interesting challenge for the architect here, which, you know, we've heard it'll be Tom Main, to build something that both fits in that context and probably challenges that context. If it's Tom, that's what he does. So I would look very much forward to the planning and architectural aspect of this, although that's only one part of what we'll have to be concerned with.
And it should be said that neither Brode nor Main confirms that he's the pick, but having some of his caliber must be a pretty exciting prospect.
Oh, more than just exciting. I mean, remember, this is somebody whose office, Morphosis, is in Santa Monica, who founded SciArc in Santa Monica. This is, a world-class architect with a local base. This is a very exciting marriage of project and architect, I would think.
Now, it's true that Santa Monica has spawned many a creative architect, including Tom Main, but also I think it's fair to say that Santa Monica can be a challenging place for very creative architects, in as much as Santa Monica does have a very strong citizen design review process that that some architects have, and I think Tom Main might even be included among them, you know, have found in the past to be quite, let's just say, challenging.
Our participatory process, there's no doubt, can make it difficult to be creative and to do things that take more than a little bit of explanation to be understood. However, I think it's a very positive process. I think that this community has served itself very well on the whole in not letting things be built that were inappropriate for the city and getting things built that we needed to do. This project is going to be different in some ways because it is an arts project. It's also going to have a certain special characteristic as part of our civic center. And one of the things we're being asked to look at on Tuesday night, tonight, is whether we can indeed accelerate the process so that we don't get bogged down. The civic center itself has been a very long planning process. We will have to revise that civic center plan and give a pretty clear go-ahead pretty quickly for this to happen.
Now, would that mean that Eli Brode would be getting some kind of preferential treatment over other developers and architects who are trying to get their projects through?
We have, as a matter of policy over the years, allowed for the streamlining of certain types of projects. One in Santa Monica that is sometimes controversial is we streamline affordable housing projects because the financing for affordable housing often is at risk if we can't quickly get through the process. So we have policy precedent for allowing streamlining for projects that have special public interest and public benefit. And I think for Santa Monica, it's pretty easy to make the case that there's a significant public benefit to having a major museum of this type in our civic center.
Well, Kevin McEwen, thank you so much for giving me your time today.
You're welcome. It's an exciting week in Santa Monica.
You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up, a comedian wants to use his green to build green. Keenan Wenz makes the case for a sustainable 16,000 square foot house. But first, the LAPD and high design. At a recent AIA Awards ceremony, I was struck by the fact that three new police stations won awards: the new headquarters in downtown by the architecture firm AECOM, and two newly opened precinct stations, Olympic by Gruen Associates and Hollenbeck by AC Martin Partners. They joined four other new precinct stations paid for with Prop Q bond money, and they were explicitly designed to further Chief Bratton's policing philosophy of openness and transparency. With his replacement, Charles Beck, being confirmed today as the new LAPD chief, we decided to look at the new face of policing in Los Angeles. To appreciate the new, however, you have to remember the old. John Buntin is author of L.A. Noir, The Struggle for the Soul of America's Most Seductive City.
In the first generation of LAPD precinct stations, many of them were lovely buildings, but sometimes quite unlovely things happened in them. But I think that really the nadir of LAPD architecture came in the 1960s with the emergence of a concept that was known as the ideal station. They were very literally fortresses, no windows, no natural light, no clear entrance. And they were devised in part so that the LAPD wouldn't have to deploy personnel to protect their own precinct stations. But obviously, they sent a very clear message to the community, and the message was that the community was dangerous and the enemy.
Tom Brennan is facilities manager for the LAPD, and he confirms John Buntin's description.
I give tours to individuals who come from other law enforcement agencies. The first place I take them is the Central Station, which is in downtown on 6th Street. And it is a building that has no windows. It is a building that you can't even see the front door from the street. And it implies a fortress mentality. It pushes the community away. It also engenders kind of the same kind of an attitude for the officers who work there, that they don't have any natural light. They are in a fortress mentality. And the new stations with the light, the community rooms, the open space, and I can tell you here at Rampart, if you drive by on a Sunday afternoon, there's more people having picnics, playing soccer, playing frisbee on the space around the police station than there are at some of the local parks. And that bringing of the community in, encouraging that interaction between the police department and the community, has definitely improved the officers' attitudes towards how they interact with the community.
As Tom explains all this, we're standing in the airy, clean-lined lobby of the year-old Rampart Station near MacArthur Park. It's hard to connect this dignified new building with the notorious Rampart scandal of just a few years ago. Outside, a couple is indeed picnicking on the grass, and to our right, folks from the neighbourhood are gathered in the community room, one of the central features, I'm told, of this and every other new precinct station. Vince Jones is programme manager for the Bureau of Engineering, and he manages the Prop Q bond programme.
This is a room that the community really uses, so they have meetings during the day, in the evening. These community rooms are set up so that it's actually a wall of doors that open up out into a patio, so that if they had a Saturday event, they can have barbecues out there and enjoy food. So again, this is part of the community policing that the LAPD has adopted.
Patio, barbecues, picnics, it sounds like we're talking about a vacation retreat. We're not, of course. For starters, the community room has a crime-fighting purpose, as I learned from Sergeant Andrew Rea, who's officer in charge of community relations at Hollenbeck Division.
You know, we were trying to work inside the criminal mind, finding out what's going on, and any pieces that we can of the puzzle that we can put together, that we can bring together, whether it's in a community room, people have a feeling of trust when you come in here because of the openness. And, you know, and it helps. You know, we go out there, we're looking for the bad guy, and we know where to look.
And it becomes clear when Vince Jones shows me around the secure part of the station, with report writing rooms and commander's office and
So this is the detention area. This is one of the holding cells that we're looking at, and it's secure. All of the doors are heavy doors. Everything inside of this room is tamper-proof. So if someone was being held while they're waiting to be transferred, they wouldn't be able to hurt themselves. That's the idea, is for them not to be able to hurt themselves or to do something that would, jeopardize the security of the police station in general.
But still, the dominant feeling is of a massive breath of fresh air for the LAPD. Clean, airy, generous architecture sweeping away the darker days of LA's finest. Deborah Weintraub is chief deputy city engineer, and she oversees all the bond programs.
I mean, I think part of our charge with the money that the voters gave us was to build buildings that were excellent in terms of their place in the urban fabric, and that provided really fantastic design and within budget. So it's been very gratifying to see all these facilities open up and to just feel a sense of pride.
Perhaps one of the most sparkling of the new stations is the newly opened Hollenbeck replacement station in Boyle Heights. It was designed by AC Martin Partners and sits on the site of the first Hollenbeck station. The designers stretched a tight budget, creating a bright lobby somehow reminiscent of a boutique hotel, with a facade of dancing folded glass panels and concrete protective walls relieved by dashes of 24 different colours, all wrapped around a public plaza. The goal, says Christopher King of AC Martin Partners, was to capture the essence of the neighbourhood, not to try and mimic Mexican-American heritage.
There were open discussions between community members, someone would say, oh, it would be great to have arches along the front and, very sort of typical, more of a almost Spanish-style type of architecture. But for every person that there was saying that, there was someone else who was actually saying, no, I like the modern interpretation and the direction that they're going because it's new and it's of the time and it's not trying to be something it's not. It's actually, kind of joining the artistic expression rather than trying to mimic something else.
Everyone I know of here is like, wow, what a difference.
Martha Cisneros is a Boyle Heights resident, active in local affairs.
What a beautiful design and architecture, because it kind of stands out a little, because we have a lot of older buildings in the area, very historical district. And this is, it's a plus, because, we have been neglected, but now it looks like we're starting to catch up.
That's Martha Cisneros, a Boyle Heights resident who's active in local affairs. And it turns out that the police themselves were active participants in the design process.
One of the most interesting things was working with the police as the user group and to help facilitate the design of this building. Many times we'd show up to the meetings with, for example, the 24 colors that were going around the outside of the building, thinking, they might be adverse to this because typically the stations have been very, very monochromatic and fortress-like. But what's interesting was the bigger and brighter the ideas were, the more the police responded. They just were advocates of the design from the beginning. So it was a really wonderful working relationship.
Don't you just love the image of our police sitting around studying colour swatches? So how do they feel about their new digs? Lieutenant Robert Miles oversaw the transition of 390-plus personnel from the 18,000-square-foot transitional building to the new one.
We moved from that to a 53,000-square-foot building. So we basically moved into the 21st century.
So much, much more space.
More space, more technology. We're in the center of the community, which is nice. It's back on the old, where the original Hollenbeck station was. This is where the citizens wanted it to be because it's so close to everybody around the area. We have state-of-the-art computers, which better services to the community. We have better phone communication with the community, better openness with the community. The station's built in a very open atmosphere, so it's working very well. This does bring its own problems as far as security goes and everything else, but we deal with those.
In what way?
Well, you've got more open space. We have a couple areas that police officers can go and have lunch or take a break, whatever, and they're not all bricked up. And some people have a problem with that; they don't feel as protected, as comfortable in those open spaces. Because, quite frankly, someone could take advantage of this and see us. I mean, unfortunately, already our building has been tagged, by some of the local gang members, which we won't mention their names. But so there's issues like that, but I think those are easily fixed. You know, the city is always working with us, always giving us more things. They can put up screens and so forth and so on. So it's an evolving process.
And what about impact on crime fighting? Do you feel there has been one?
Definitely been impact. One, the morale of the station has improved. We have more space. The officers have better space to operate in, better technology. So definitely that increases it. They want to be here. They want to work hard.
But the technology is really key. It's not just the building, it's the technology.
Oh, yeah, yes. The city has improved our computer systems. They've improved our data collection systems. They've improved our real-time reporting systems. I mean, we know within 24 hours what's going on. And that's the huge leap that we've had.
Now, the other thing about law enforcement is, or rather the new buildings as they relate to law enforcement is, if you're standing in the lobby, you could be in a boutique hotel. But then, you know, there's a private area. You've let me into the private area, but there's the private area where the public doesn't go, where crime is being enforced, just like it was always enforced. Yeah, so how does one, I guess in terms of this connection to the community, how do you strike a balance between being like your local friendly police officer and, you know, being the strong enforcer against crime?
I think you bring up a good point. When people come into our lobby, several things have happened to them. Their life is either chaotic, they're a victim of a crime, they're a little confused, they don't know quite what they need to do. There's sometimes a language barrier. And when they come into this news station, into that lobby, it's very peaceful. It's very calming. And that's the effect we want to give them. We don't want them to walk into something that looks militaristic and very sterile and very cold. We want them to feel welcome here. So they come to the desk. It's designed that way. And it's low, where it's more eye contact. And there's nice comfort seating and that kind of stuff. So I think that's what we want to present up front. Now, once that's done and we take our crime reports, we bring those that commit crimes back here. This is a very sterile environment. This is very processing orientated. You come in here, you've been arrested, you go in our holding cell, and we do what we need to do, and we take you downtown. That's what this part needs to be. But I think the city hit it right on the head with the front lobby. It's very, very welcoming.
I asked John Bunton, author of L.A. Noir, what he thought about this apparent disjunction between front and back of house.
Well, that is a fascinating question. I mean, an oft-cited definition of you know, the modern state holds that the state is that entity which monopolizes violence in a society. And police departments, despite the current and entirely appropriate concern with relating to serving, interacting with local communities, you know, do have at their core that mission of violence containment, and they are, you know, instruments of force. So I think that while you can provide precinct stations with, you know, courtyards, cafes, free Wi-Fi, you know, landscape that draws people in rather than keeping them out, you know, there will always be that element of violence and force. It's just part of policing, and it's one of the things that interests us so much about policing.
For the police themselves, like Sergeant Andrew Rea, the open new building in Boyle Heights does reinforce a fundamental shift in the practice of policing in Los Angeles.
You know what? 28 years on the job. It's been a great career. But, you know, you see the changes and the evolutions. And, yeah, this is a good time right now. You know, never in my wildest dreams did I ever think of looking at these computers and PowerPoint presentation and saying, hey, this is how we can help the people so they can actually see with their own eyes what's going on. You know, in my day when you came on, you were just tied to the radio. You're just listening. And you had a hot sheet in front of you. You just flipped some pages. That's all you had. And you went on and you tried to do police work with your windows down. And in today's era, I mean, you have everything at your disposal, state-of-the-art computers, up-to-date information in your patrol car.
And then you have a building that, I don't know whether you even know this, but it's been winning architectural awards.
Yeah, we have a couple of awards for this. It's a green station. So I believe we've got the Platinum Award for the station. And it's come together. You know, and then all of a sudden you throw a bunch of officers in it, and, you know, it makes for a great place. You know, it really does. And like I said, the openness, it makes it's fun. It's fun to come to work now, you know, and have a good time and put the bad guy in jail.
That was Sergeant Andrew Rare, community liaison for the Hollenbeck Division in Boyle Heights. If you want to go visit the new precinct stations, see our website for a list of locations. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Global warming has presented material culture with a conundrum. Can one have it all while consuming less? Keenan Ivory Wayans, the comedian and creator of In Living Colour, White Chicks and much, much more, well, he thinks it's possible. He's about to break ground on a 16,000 square foot house in Malibu that he hopes will get a top LEED rating. The house is being created by a team known more frankly for meeting the needs of the super rich than Mother Earth. Architect Richard Landry, interior designer Martin Lawrence Bullard, and builder John Finton. I met recently with Keenan, Martin, and John, and we discussed whether their project is viable or an oxymoron. Here's Keenan.
We live in an aspirational culture, and that's not going to change. So we're going to build big houses. What we can do is build them better, build them more efficient, and build them green. And we chose to do a Tuscan-style home because we wanted to show that aesthetically you can build a beautiful house. It doesn't have to be restrictive in terms of your architectural choices.
But I think you're going for a LEED certification. In fact, I think you're going for gold or platinum, something very high. And as I understand it, they do make the point that it is greener to be smaller. In fact, increasingly they're talking about giving certifying buildings not just as single buildings, but in relation to their community. And they're making the argument that it really is greener to site a building in a dense situation, that New York is greener than LA because you walk everywhere, you don't have to drive, and that a 1,500 square foot house just consumes less than a 10,000 square foot house, and that they do give points accordingly. So can we just revisit this question of size and how you can reconcile the huge size with the LEED, if you are going for LEED?
Well, first off, the house is not just me in this house. I have five children. I also have my workspace in the house. We will have an organic farm on the property. So the size, for me, is part aspirational and part functional because, like I said, the size of my family and my workspace. In addition to that, I have an immediate family of 50. So I have 10 brothers and sisters and 36 nieces and nephews. So we can't have Christmas in a 1,500 square foot house.
You can't even have dinner in a 1,500 square
foot. So this is, you know, like I said, it sounds large to other people, but when you think about the numbers that are going to be in this space, this is a practical house.
So actually, he gets the LEED zircon rating for putting an entire community in a house. You're going to be like Louis XIV, you know, with your legions of family and courtiers. And that's great. Now, are you going to be tilling the land yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm a comedian. I'm not a gardener. No.
Well, there's the comedy. That's your next movie. Keenan does gardening.
Yeah, well, that would be a comedy. Yeah.
So, John, I suppose the question is it so far in the other direction from living sustainably that one should just accept these are luxury homes and that's fine, but let's not call them green?
I still believe that they can be green. You can still use responsible materials. You can still insulate them properly. They can still function, you know, as a sustainable home. And you can still be responsible with it. I think that, you know, to draw a line in the sand and say that it has to be, you know, on a small scale or else it's not sustainable, I think, unfortunately, is not where we want to go. And I think the challenge is most of the time when people think about green, you think about ugly solar panels on your house and, you know, appliances that are efficient and things that all of us have kind of seen. But when it comes down to it, a lot of the clients aren't willing to make the sacrifices. You know, it sounds great, you know, talking about it, but when it comes time to actually do it, some of this stuff isn't that attractive. So our challenge is going to be to try and balance what Martin is going to want what Keenan wants in his house, which makes sense for he and his family, and then what's going to also be sustainable and going to work in terms of the green aspect.
So, Martin, what do you want? How do you feel about having sort of discovered the eco in you?
You know, it was kind of scary. A few months ago, I just thought it was a color. But it's interesting because I think that the road to eco-chic is a journey, not a destination. I think that what I love to create beautiful, luxurious, glamorous, comfortable homes. And the thing that I've learned through this process and through this extraordinary thing that Keenan's trying to do is that you don't have to give up any of those things to be green. For certain, we're going to bring into the architecture as much reclaimed as we possibly can. We're looking at beautifully reclaimed floors. We're looking at reclaimed ceilings, to use antique doors. There's nothing greener than antiques. You know, that's the true green item, because we're completely reusing something that's already been made and not having to do anything to it. It's not until you really start examining the things that we use, the textures, the wall coverings, the fabrics, and then all of the things like the heating systems, the water systems, all of those sort of hidden things, all those ugly things I don't want to see.
So, John, where the trend today for some is to within modern architecture is to absolutely make a feature of some of the new sustainable systems, you want to actually conceal the workings and have it appear to be like any other magnificent house in the Italianate tradition. Now, in the actual Italian tradition, if one was to go back two or 300 years, when people were building in the vernacular tradition, when they were responding to the climate and to the topography in the sort of pre-air conditioning days, is that something also that you learn from your travels in Italy?
Clearly. I mean, obviously, this home's in Malibu. You know, the climate itself is cool. A lot of the homes that we build in Malibu don't have air conditioning. You know, it's not necessary, or it may be set up for air conditioning. You know, in our case, we're going to. But clearly, this is a home that's sited, obviously, to take advantage of, you know, a good many things, views and other things.
Now, you've talked about materials, and you're sourcing them from the original source, Italy, and other places. But one of the other sort of factors that's increasingly being talked about now with respect to eco-sensitivity of materials and so on is the distribution of materials and the travelling that's involved, the carbon footprint of shipping materials from some far-off place. And increasingly there's talk of getting more regional, of cultivating local craftspeople. Is that something that's part of the thinking at all? Are there people in LA that you're looking to for materials and ideas?
Yes, I think that we're looking to source as much as we possibly can locally, because obviously the footprint's very important, and it's part of the whole LEED rating system. You know, there are certain things that one can't find locally that we will have to bring in, but as much as we possibly can, we're going to source things here.
So are you keen in enjoying this process of this project of the house, which is probably as big as a film in many ways? And
Well, we're about to break ground real soon. So maybe you ask me in about 6 months how much fun I'm having. But right now, yes, we're having a ball. It's been fun just figuring it out.
That was Keenan Wayans, the comedian who's getting serious about sustainability. His house breaks ground this month. And that's it for today's DNA. Thanks very much for listening. The show was produced by Ray Guana with production assistance from Alyssa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Farrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. You can podcast DNA, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. Or you can get it from iTunes. And if you'd like to comment on our show, post your thoughts at kcrw.com/DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Join me next month for more DNA.